I don't even have to worry about it. I'm auto-tuned.
Yeah, that sounds great.
It'll
right
all
there.
Work out in production.
Or video chat.
Oh, I wasn't supposed to.
Welcome to the Mediocre Movie Cast, Deadwood Edition, in which we go through a series rewind of one of the greatest TV shows ever made. I'm filthy, piss-spraying beast John Kissel, and with me tonight is a pie-faced cocksucker named Shane.
Yo!
And with his Finnish fucking accent is Brian.
Hey, I got that this time, and it's, I think they say Finland accent.
I don't know. I we're going to have to go to the transcript for that.
Because
one.
I thought it was weird because she didn't like assume that it was a language.
She says Finland, Finnish, a whole bunch. Maybe she just says Finland. I don't know. Here nor there.
Well, I know for a fact that Brian watches with the
closed captioning.
Closed captioning.
As do I.
So, oh, whoa. Maybe we have dueling closed captioning.
HBO Go and the DVDs, they don't agree on what people are actually saying. Wow. Anyways,
HBO?
Shane and I are Deadwood repeat viewers.
It's on Amazon, has it?
Yes. Yeah, they do. That's right. That's how you
Everybody
watch it?
Everybody has it.
That's this how is,
all right, the intro's it. Been destroyed.
That's all right. Brian already talked over the music.
Great. Yeah, so we're
I
doing
good.
I
wasn't listening during that part. I thought that was just something you two needed to take care of.
Anyway,
and then I was dancing in front of the camera, and Chelsea was looking at me and asking me what I'm doing.
Oh my
and
God.
So here we are.
For those joining us for the first time, Shane and I are Deadwood repeat viewers and actively pursue our destinies in the hills. And Brian, who is watching this masterpiece for the first time, is being called to the fold, though he might not even be of Shane and mine's flock. In this episode, we'll be discussing episodes 13 and or 1 and 2 of Deadwood's second season, 13th to 14th episodes overall, entitled A Lie Agreed Upon, Parts 1 and 2. We ended the first season a week ago, and now we're going to dive into what Shane is always saying is the best TV season ever, and we'll find out if Brian and I agree by the end of it. Brian is only about halfway through the second season when he very politely stopped when we asked him to. So
you're welcome.
The next, in about a month, we're going to have some really great episodes. So
I thought,
listener,
I'm just going to say,
right.
These two episodes are better than anything from season one, except for the amount of Bullock screen time. And now there's two, three Bullocks.
So you need to be more specific because William Bullock very much swings his arms when he walks.
He's fine. But Mrs. Bullock, I'm jumping the gun. I've got my notes ready for this okay. later.
It's been about 6-7 months since the previous episode. Things
How
have,
do we know this?
It's show, like extras, show notes, extra textual information.
Did we miss all of winter?
Yes. Wild Bill was killed in August of 1876. And I'd say about 6 weeks to 2 months took place throughout the rest of the season. And they do, I believe they mentioned that it's spring of the following year, 1877. And
I
in that period,
there would have been a ton of snow otherwise.
You would think so, yeah, which is probably why they didn't want to show it.
Right.
In the intervening period, the town is getting friendlier and friendlier with the Dakota territories represented by Yankton. Bullock and Alma, having officially started their relationship in the previous episode, have been continuing down that path, flaunting privacy and propriety. Bullock's family is arriving into the camp at this time. Trixie and Saul, their relationship has been progressing. And the episode begins with the decay of all these relationships. Al is receiving some bad news from Yankton about how the commissioners for this new territory will not be represented by anyone from Deadwood. They'll be outsiders that are going to put their finger on the scale and make lives presumably more difficult for those who pursued their destinies in the hills. And like I said, there's a stagecoach rumbling in the town containing Bullock's family while he is aggressively making love to Alma and knocking paint chips onto poor Sophia's head. General settings. Just not a lot happened in the off season. There's not a lot. They don't spend a lot of time setting up the new status quo for Deadwood, because it's more or less the same, and we're seeing it as it's changing.
Well, I don't know if I agree that not a lot has happened, because I think the biggest plot point for this opening part of the season has happened. It's the status quo. It's Bullock fucking Alma, but Bullock's Boy Scout rating, I suppose, has gone down, and that's pissing people off, because that's not who they bargained for sheriff. It wasn't some guy who's going to be fucking some lady who, you know, and being a bit derelict in his duties.
I would say that it's coming to a head in this episode, certainly, with Al calling Bullock out from the thoroughfare, essentially about that, triggered by hearing the bad news from Yankton. Potentially, and this is, again, extra textual, but maybe Bullock, if he had better focus, he might have been able to prevent this from happening. But as it stands, the camp is suffering a defeat.
Suffering a defeat? What are you talking about, suffering a defeat?
That they're just not being represented
in the
state legislature. They didn't get any county commissioners appointed from Deadwood. And I think that's what Al very much wanted. Like, what were all those bribes for if we're not going to be represented in the legislature?
Right.
And that's going to be the thrust of this new season, is the terms, like, who gets to negotiate the terms of Deadwood entering the United States? Is it going to be Deadwood itself, or is it going to be just people from outside coming in and saying, this is how it's going to be? And
this is like one of the couple times we've seen Al really out of control. The other was when he was drinking too much in season one, and this one he just pounding the whiskey.
Yeah. And when Al gets drunk, he tends to lash out at people.
Right. So I assume we're talking about the fight now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one thing that I feel like, having thrown out my back previously, is that Al's in a lot of pain right now, and your temper, basically, or your level of patience becomes zero the more pain you're in. And I think that plays a larger role than the alcohol does.
That's likely very true, because Al is also experiencing some declining health with kidney stones and prostate issues. And he's not in a good place. He's pretty miserable.
And Bullock is in love and is the white knight. How dare you say something about him and Alma?
Yeah, as irresponsible as Bullock is being. Because I think the idea is that, they've just been... Everybody knows. No one says anything.
Why is he being irresponsible?
Because he's kind of like shirking his duties. Like I said, he's kind of like the Boy Scout. He's got to be the guy who does things right. He can't be the one who is out fucking around, getting drunk, or whatever. You know, like whatever. Like he's the Boy Scout. He's almost your... He's supposed to be that moral replacement for the good reverend.
Right, but can Boy Scouts not have sex?
Not if they're married. I mean, and with their not wife.
But do people know?
I think that? Once you get your Eagle Scout badge, then it kind of opens up the wider world.
And, this opens it up for a lot of inappropriate Boy Scout.
Sure, yeah.
Because I'm not going to let you go there, okay? You have your Catholic jokes.
Yeah. I mean, they're all those type of jokes are all localized within Catholicism. I tend to leave the Scouts alone.
Leave the Boy Scouts alone.
I get less sour grapes from the Boy Scouts than I do the Catholic Church. But I think, like, Bullock, his distraction also makes him vulnerable. Like, he is a married man, and this puts it, like, if someone was inclined to, he could be compromised by this being exposed, by like naming it, it would expose Bullock. Because again, everyone knows about this. EB feels like he can make jokes about this, to which everyone is not interested in, but it doesn't stop him any.
So now everyone's on my side that Bullock isn't that great.
No, so
he's just human. Oh. He's human is all. He's never been. He's presumably never been in love before, like he is. We get more of his backstory in these two episodes.
Well, I don't know. At one point, I got a quote from him where he's talking about, "I've made partial payment to them, questioning the possible duplication." And then, like moments later, he's making out with Alma and nearly swallowing her face. Like, it's just awkward. Everything he does is just so weird.
I think that speaks to just how strange their relationship is. Like, they still refer to themselves as Mr. Bullock and Mrs. Garrett. It's very passionate, but it's also strangely formal, as if they're just not comfortable in this space.
Right. They've both been repressed their entire lives, and they continue to repress themselves.
They're taking it out on each other with 1.5 mouth size kisses.
Sure.
Which is, weird. You know, the best way for anyone to take it out on anyone else.
And there's also Alma's
to open your mouth and try to swallow them whole.
I mean, sorry, keep going. Inappropriate joke coming from Brian.
No problem.
It's like going toward Brian and saying,
"Oh yeah, everything stops."
It's a new day. You can't make those jokes because you gotta grow up sometime. Okay, Brian?
I don't know what you're even talking about.
Well, I was not gonna make a homophobic joke in your direction. That's not what I was gonna do.
Okay.
That's not what we're about here.
No.
Seth and Al's quarrel takes up the bulk of the episode, or bulk of the episodes. In the first season, they have a violent confrontation. In the first episode. In the second episode, there's a threat of another violent confrontation, but Al diffuses it and kind of shows his ass to Bullock, acknowledges that he's essentially in charge, and they're going to try and row in the same direction again. And this was all a big misunderstanding.
I think the lead up, you know, the gathering of troops and everything to the showdown, where the viewer doesn't know what Al and Bullock are going to do, if they're going to fight or shoot each other, if it's going to become a shootout. I think the lead up to that was really, really good. Until you find out that Al's just going to give him his gun back.
Yeah, and throw his hat down.
Right, but there was just like so much build up, the sound, the characters, everybody getting involved. I thought that was a really good set of scenes.
Yeah, another one of Deadwood's strong uses of space, where all these people are coming out to see what the commotion is and coming out from different buildings and choosing sides and picking sides. And
it's one of those times,
a lot of the main cast there.
Yeah, where like the climax isn't necessarily like this big violent outburst. And you're fine with it, you know.
Yeah.
Even in the first episode, it's only like halfway. I think it's only 20 minutes in, where Al and Bullock have their throwdown, you know. And that to me, you think normally that'd be the end of an episode. That'd be like for Game of Thrones, that's episode 9 of the season.
Right.
And here they threw it out in the first 20 minutes, and they let other things be the climax of the emotions, let people's decisions, you know, they let you watch Alma Garrett go through a breakup, all the stages of grief, in the last 40 minutes of that episode. And that you're more interested in that than the actual fight. The fight's not great.
Right. The fight was going through it the second time. I remember it being longer, but it was real short. It wasn't even as long as Bullock beating up on Alma's dad.
I agree. It is really fast. It gets over. It's so seared in my memory, that scene. But it is done. It's quick.
Right.
I think Deadwood has a very strong sense of violence, and that these things can't just go on forever. Like, if you get on top of someone in the horse shit and are pounding their face in, they're not going to get up and all of a sudden start fighting back with all their might. It's going to seriously mess them up. And, and this is after falling off of a balcony and trading headbutts. And it's a really, it feels like a realistic bout of violence. Just because of how fast it is. Like, I feel like if I or you guys got into a fight, it'd be over pretty quickly.
Well, it depends on who am I fighting? Am I fighting Brian?
I don't think it really matters.
Like that would be
that'd be a good 3-minute slap fight.
To see.
I think a fight between me and Kissel might last as long as our foot race at Myrtle Beach did.
It'd probably end about the same way. It would be like a huge with me like having a huge bruise on my hamstring after. It'd just be a complete physical disaster.
And me running away.
Looks like I'm dying. Yeah. Yeah, and Shane running away after tripping me. Fantastic. It's a solid metaphor for my violent history. Martha and William Bullock also arrive into town right at the perfect moment because William disarms Al with his innocence. A pretty cold relationship. I feel like Seth and Martha have had maybe 2 or 3 meetings together in their entire life. Like this is number 3 or 4. They're frosty. They're a frosty couple, as is probably accurate, because they have never loved each other. This is a marriage of custom and tradition, more out of any passion or anything like that. William seems like a cool kid. I like that actor. You really get to know him and what he and his general attitude on the stagecoach ride. Like he's introduced being entranced by the momentum of the stagecoach jostling the prostitute's breast that he's sharing a stagecoach with, and he farts in there and is bashful after. He makes a little tiny smile at Al with his big eyes, and he very much admires Bullock once they actually arrive in town. You know, children actors, you never know. I think they did well here with him.
He's a lot better than the other two Bullocks.
It's easy for a kid to be personable, and that goes away over time, I think, especially in this time period, especially if Seth Bullock is going to be your guardian. They're products of their time.
One of the three that seems to have any sort of emotion other than flat.
Wow. Well, I think Anna Gunn is probably. She's also. That's Martha, by the way. Actress Martha. Like, she has to play someone who is pretty flat because, I mean, it's a time where she doesn't have much, I think, like, rights or much. I mean, no husband and a kid. Like, what options do you have?
Right.
So you repress any opinion and just deal with it.
But maybe show her, I don't know, maybe this happens later, give her a scene where she's sad at some point, where she's looking at something and it reminds her of her husband, or she has, you know, a fight with her kid and she's sad afterwards, rather than just so stoic about everything. She has,
sure.
There's really no character other than flat there.
I think her stoicism is a good match for Bullock's initial appearance. I mean, we know that he's not a stoic person as much as he tries to be. But we're meeting someone who actually is. Like Bullock has his weaknesses for temper. And I mean, at this point, we don't know a lot about Martha, but she seems to be the real deal as far as serious minded person who knows the score. Like Bullock brought her to this place. Their options are limited, like Shane said. I feel like the only other possibility for her would have been to go back to her family. We don't know anything about her family. We don't know a lot about Bullock's. Well, Bullock's father is dead. He doesn't mention his mother. So presumably it's just him. So yeah, she's going to be polite and defer to her husband, as blinkered as her husband might be. And we're going to get to spend some more time with her. I think she makes a great first impression. I really like their relationship. We might talk about this more a little later. Like, just all the stuff with Bullock and Martha and his family, that really worked for me here. I love Bullock's recitation internally of the letter at the end of episode 1. Just I've built this sturdy foundation for us, even though it's built on the sand of our of our arrangement. Like, our arrangement is not built on anything sturdy, but I'm going to put you in this place that is sturdy.
His writing there is much better than his speaking parts.
Yeah. So,
the reading of his letters.
Speaking of that narration over the final part of that episode, these are two episodes in a row that finish with narrations. What did you guys think about those? Did you like that?
I mean, it's a new flourish for the show. I don't feel strongly one way or the other. I like what they're saying, but like directorially, dramatically, anything like that, it didn't change any opinions or anything.
I like it. Gives, they were both very poetic. Pretty lines involved.
Yeah,
a compliment for Bullock. A compliment for Bullock and his writing.
There we go. There we go. So obviously it's an A+.
The last plot thread in these two episodes would be Joni and the Bella Union accompanying Martha and William to camp is Joni's friend, Maddie, who they've been partners with before, and she's bringing with other prostitutes, and they're going to start their new endeavor, the Chez Ami, a high-end whorehouse, backed by Eddie, all the funds that he stole, and he's now gone out of the series. But he did his job. He got Joni the money, and she's going to start building her new business, even though Sai is enraged by this development and insists on a share, or he'll start killing his own whores, which Joni, being a person, is attached to. So the new endeavor comes with strings. But Maddie as a new character, I think, is great. I don't know what the actress's name is, but I love the way she talks, and we're going to hear a sampling of that a little later. But she just talks really low and it's like a power move, I think, where she like wants people to lean in, like, oh, I didn't quite hear you. What were you saying? And they're being disarmed by her in a way. I really like that character.
It's one of the things you can do in teaching when you want your students to pay attention. Like, if you naturally are really loud, like I tend to be in front of the classroom, if you get really quiet, oftentimes it'll get everybody to be quiet and listen to you.
Yeah, power moves.
Yeah.
There you go. I'm going to use that on my intern tomorrow.
There you go.
Benzene Law Group, blowing up.
That's right. By the way, this episode is brought to you by Benzene Law Group. We'll get you the justice you need and the money you deserve. So if you've been injured in the state of Georgia, let me know. Or Florida.
What if you're like on your way to Georgia?
If the insurance policy holder is from Georgia, I can help you out.
So like if someone flew up here and like punched me in the face from Georgia, would I go to Georgia for that or Illinois?
Yeah, we could zoom here.
Okay. All right.
So there you go.
Great. And back to the episode.
Okay.
That's what's called a live read, kids. Pay extra money for that.
Anything else you guys want to mention as far as events of these two episodes before you move on to scenes of the week?
I think there's a thread that you're kind of missing. I mean, it kind of goes in with the Al thread. It kills me every time I watch these two episodes. It's Dan is Al's child, I think, or I don't even know how to describe it. He will say anything Al says. Like, I love him parroting back what Al says to Johnny Burns as if it's his own thing that he's saying. It kills me every time. Dan crying when he thinks that Al takes Adam's aside and Al is forced to he's forced to tell him, no, listen, you and I would have done something different. If we put someone up on a 12-point buck, we would have twisted him. But that guy wouldn't, because he's a pussy. You know, it's like, that's what he does to appease Dan. And that's one of the reasons, that relationship right there is, I think, one of the reasons like these two episodes are among my favorite. I've probably watched them a dozen times.
They have a very hierarchical sense in the gym. And Adams is someone who throws that whole balance off. But the hierarchy is so strange for like middle-aged men. And Johnny, he's probably like in his 30s just dad and older brother and baby brother. Then they all explain things to each other. And now that baby brother is dead and Jimmy Irons, it's like Johnny got a promotion. like Dan, just a giant who is just a little kid inside. It's a nice new flavor for him. Brian, you got something about the newspaper guy here.
I do. I'll save that for last.
Okay.
So I'll be so excited to talk about that. A couple of quick notes. When they were hanging electricity up, I thought that was kind of neat to see.
I don't know. Is that electricity or telegraph wires?
Telegraph.
It is telegraph wires.
It was just kind of, it was neat to see something having taken very little history in my life to see a video of that. I thought that was neat. It's like, what's that movie we watched at Eberfest that I didn't like?
Blowout?
Blowout, where they have, some behind the scenes thing, just a quick snip of some piece of history or how something's done that I didn't already know. That was neat. When Bullock is waking up from his concussion or whatever's going on, and they use a blurry cam to try to recreate his vision, I thought that was really well done. Just technically, it was neat. And I have here that Cy he's talking about the stagecoach arriving, and then later on he's pouring the champagne in the girl's mouth, and he's just making my skin crawl at this point.
Yeah, he is pretty repulsive in that first episode. Yeah, I think you can assume that Joni has been back in the Bella Union for these last several months, just waiting for Maddie to arrive. And as far as I knows, just things are back to normal. And things are back to what he always wanted. And then to find out, and I'm not making excuses for him because, again, he is awful, especially in that last scene in the first episode. But for his ideal scenario to suddenly be revealed as bullshit, he just takes that in the worst way possible. And follows that up with giving the world's worst pep talk in the next episode. anything else on the updates?
Newspaper guy, evidently calls himself at one point AW.
Himself that when he was first introduced in the pilot,
I wasn't in love with him at that point. And so now it's a big deal, and I want to know.
It doesn't matter, and you're still going to call him newspaper guy, I presume.
Now, Merrick, I'm learning. It took me a while. It was really funny. Like, I typed this note up, and for the first hour and 15 minutes it was in there. Yeah, I just had newspaper guy until he was referred to again, and then I filled in his actual name.
I assume it stands for ambulating Wilbur something like that.
Yeah, that would be great. I was thinking that, the probability of Shane having another kid before me is higher. He could name his next kid Merrick. That's a good, unique first name.
That's a good name. It's not the name I picked out. Oh. But
we're not talking about Joe here. We're talking about Shane. It's relatively long times. Yeah.
I'm actually going to name him after you, Brian. I'm going to name him Third Guy.
Third G.
Will his first name just be Third and then middle name Guy? Third.
I'm a hyphenate it. There's something a little more traditional for the middle name. Third guy, Jonathan, probably.
There you go. I'll remember this podcast series forever.
of course. As the world will remember this forever. I don't know what you're implying, Brian.
I'm implying we need more 5-star iTunes reviews.
We absolutely do. Review us on iTunes, Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I don't know how we're exactly referred to in iTunes. Is it Mediocre Movie Cast or Mediocre Movie Club?
Search for Mediocre Movie Club. We're the only ones that show up.
Even you, Mom, please give us a 5-star. I know you stopped listening 30 minutes ago. But
scenes of the week. A lot to choose from, but I picked the often maligned Bullock talking about his brother. I love this scene. like, Bullock met his brother. Well, not met. From the time Bullock was 13, he never saw his brother again, and he's patterned so much of his life after this person. And to hear Bullock talk about him, his usual deadpan voice, there's just a lot of admiration. There's a lot of warmth in there. Thinking about missed visits and letters that they had with each other and meeting Martha and the baby William, and then just hearing it all go to shit and the world interrupting on their plans. And then he breaks down, and Charlie Eder has the good sense to pretend that he farted and walk away so as not to be awkward. just some really nice humor to leaven the pathos.
Yeah.
I think Oliphant kills it there. He's not the best actor on the show, but when given the opportunity, he more than delivers.
Yeah, Utter really helps out. Like, I feel like Charlie Utter is just constantly a guy whose two parents are getting divorced and he's trying to keep them together. I mean, between that and with Jane, and it's just, and you know, with Wild Bill before that, like anything awkward or anything awful that someone would feel bad, he always has a way to kind of deflect it, it seems like, and in this episode in particular.
He's like an emotional fixer. He knows what to say and what not to say. Like, he's running interference for Bullock in the whole second episode. Like, just don't go back to the gym just yet. I have fake vertigo. Take me back to my place. Just stretching out the inevitable. Without, if he like automatically said to Bullock at the start, like, just hold on, this is stupid, don't do it. I think he knows Bullock well enough to know that that wouldn't work.
Right.
And he plays to his better instincts. He's a secret MVP of Deadwood, Charlie Utter.
Absolutely. Yeah, and he absolutely nails these two episodes, I feel like.
Yeah. Next scene of the week.
Brian, I have two I can choose from, so you go ahead and go.
I forgot I was even supposed to choose one.
Oh my God, how many times have we done this?
Well, I forget every time. I usually just go grab a quote. My scene of the week is Merrick walking away at the end, and Bullock says to him, "I don't want to talk about it." And Merrick says, "As a practical matter, self-censorship of the rigor which obtains from this camp so muzzles the press as to make the First Amendment a hollow superfluity." And, I mean, he's just... I feel like the rest of the episode doesn't fit there.
You think like that should be a cut to black?
Like, well, I don't even know how it fits. I mean, I'm glad he's in there. But I don't know. I wish they would have used him then more than just a cutaway at the end. I didn't really understand.
I was hoping someone would
insight there.
I was hoping someone would bring up that ending to the second episode, because that's that conversation between Al and Merrick. We talked about like American exceptionalism briefly in the last episode, and Merrick is that kind of person who talks about manifest destiny and truth and decency, whereas Al sees that in reference to like why this episode goes on and what was the point of Merrick. Like, Al is giving the lie to all that, like that. What's decent about General Crook massacring that village of Indians? Where are we? We're in a place that should not exist and only exists because the U.S. breaks its treaties. How dare anyone allude to decency here? The truth is not decent. The truth doesn't have to be decent. And the truth is often indecent or not decent at all.
Right. The interaction between Merrick and Al when they're having that discussion, and that would be my scene of the week. I just wanted some insight on the throwaway sort of at the end after what was one of Merrick's better scenes of the entire
as far as what he says to Bullock.
Yeah.
I think there he's just frustrated with Bullock. I don't know that there's too much more to it. Like, Bullock's just not the kind of person that's going to talk about his actions to the press. He's he again, like, he thinks of himself as a stoic person, and something a stoic person would do would be to keep their motivations and their actions to themselves. Any fourth estate interests be damned.
Gotcha. I'm just curious.
I mean, that is a really good... I really do like that conversation between Al and Merrick at the end. Just what other show would include a very dense discussion like that?
Right, mixed in with Merrick stuttering and Al then commenting on, is that your impersonation of the Indians?
And then Al writing the article for Merrick, right? Essentially. Shane, you ready?
Well, just the scene I didn't use was just the stagecoach scene. I know we mentioned it earlier. Nice job of some humor, watching boobies bounce and farting. We don't need to go into that too much. It's just a fun scene. I'm glad they added that. But the scene I think that I really love, and I think probably twice a year I make my Facebook status, is he's just 12-pointed Slippery Dan. I just absolutely love he gets in Hawkeye's face. He's just so pissed off at Adams. You know, Dan knows he can't strike at Adams. And Hawkeye just keeps being a smartass. Hawkeye thinks he's as invincible as Adams is. Jesus, Dan just beats the shit out of him. And Adams knows he can't get back at Dan. So he's like, well, fuck Slippery Dan. It was a piece of shit. And, you know.
The whole saga of Slippery Dan and Bummer Dan. Only that could have played out a little longer.
I was watching last night and Blair walked out of the room and she's like, okay, what just happened in this scene? I was like, okay, so Bummer Dan. He's just so ridiculous. They just have like these absurd characters, these side characters, but they totally work. They totally work. All of them work. I mean, and all the actors are good. They all perform well. They have great lines. They deliver well. It's just amazing that all these side spots are going to hit like they do, and that all does.
But and everyone's favorite side character in Soapy had a...
Someone say something.
Came back in a big way in that first episode.
Yeah.
Bullock had enough and just carrying him by his belt away from Honest Businessman.
Yeah, that was great. count the paces with me. 15. Great stuff.
For our character focus this week, we're going to talk about Saul Starr. Regretfully, we're not going to have him in our Cruel Masquerade as Brian portrays Saul so well. But he got a bit of a focus this week. He gets shot in the standoff between Seth and Al. And he spends the next episode a little disillusioned, a little disabused of his accommodating language. Like, zoom out. Who speaks in what way in Deadwood is very indicative of how they approach the world. Like Al says fuck every other sentence and oftentimes twice in a sentence, just to demonstrate how dangerous he is. And Jane says it because she just doesn't care, or is constantly profane because she just doesn't care. And Doc is profane because he knows better than to be civil in a lot of cases. Whereas someone like Alma doesn't curse because she's a society woman, and Saul doesn't curse because he's trying always to sell to people. And in the second episode in particular, we see a side of Saul that doesn't feel the need to sell to anyone. He's just saying exactly what he's thinking, and we find out that Saul's quite a perceptive person in his chat with Bullock.
That's because he's on drugs.
That also helps.
Finally, but he's self-aware enough to mention it.
You know what? I like being loaded.
Yeah, that's the line. There you go.
Yeah, he's unbuttoning his collar, certainly, with a rifle bullet in his shoulder. And, I mean, we talked a lot about, or not a lot, because he wasn't very much of a focus in the previous season, but we talked about Saul being the angel on Bullock's shoulder, and... just a calming presence in general for the camp. A genuinely good guy who is there to sell pots and pans, but in general has people's best interests at heart. And hearing more from him and seeing more from him makes that second episode really pop.
Yeah, and John Hawks, he's such a good actor. I enjoy what he does here with Saul Starr. and it's good to see him getting more screen time and more dialogue. And his character, and Saul Star himself, is just someone who's frustrated with, yeah, he's an angel on Seth's shoulder, but he's been ignored for a while at this point, and he's pissed off. Just like everyone else is, because Bullock really is betraying the persona that he built himself and he wants to be viewed as. And he's demanding everyone, I think, in a way, he probably is demanding everyone see him this way when he's just not. He's not that Boy Scout. Again, it comes down to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's angry at Seth for getting him shot, but it doesn't prevent him, loaded and hobbled, in joining Seth at the end of the second episode to potentially get shot again, or worse. So he can be angry, but he's still a good friend. And often the mark of a good friend is telling someone the truth. And Saul is able to tell Bullock the truth, that he's being foolish and short-sighted and selfish. And just seeing Saul really blow up on Bullock in that way, it's a great scene.
So I think from a friendship standpoint, that's a good point. These are two guys who can get in a fight with each other. And it's kind of like you view them as kind of like brothers. And they're able, which, you know, if you had brothers growing up, you know you got in a fight. And then like 20 minutes later, you're just like totally cool with somebody, you know, or a sibling in general. I don't think it's a big brother. But these two guys seem to just kind of, there's no residual anger with that, with Saul and Bullock.
Yeah.
Right. I think one of the best lines in their deep discussion is Saul says, talking about Bullock wanting to leave camp or whatever, and he says, "You think shame would end when you cleared the camp?" Bullock replies, it's shameful either way, Saul. And Saul, almost yelling at this point, says, "It's life either way, Seth." I thought that was a good interaction between two good characters.
Yeah. It's so hard for Bullock to talk about anything emotional in this fashion that Saul really has to drag it out of him. And I think the yelling is an important part of it. Like, it's like a slap to Bullock's face. Like, you need to listen to me. You need to listen to what I'm saying. And it works. Right. Everything's fine at the end.
Saul still has his fatal flaw in being having the hots for Trixie in her leather jacket.
I mean, he's a charmer. He gets in a lot. Our next section is favorite quotes, but he has a lot of good quotes with Trixie. Just breaking down her defenses very slowly, because Trixie has a whole bunch of defenses, offering to give Charlie Utter the open air blowjob. she's in a panic. She's reverting to what she knows. Things are stressful. If Saul can just abuse her of this by making little jokes and japes, then more power to him. Anything else on Saul? Close the book on him for now.
Yeah.
Move on to favorite quotes.
So many quotes this week.
Yeah.
So many
quotes. I stopped writing them down in the second episode because I'm like, I have too many.
I'll kick it off with Alma saying, "I was raised believing dereliction of duty is the one sure way to happiness."
That is a good one. I'm glad someone wrote that down.
Not something that Bullock needs to hear, but a good quote nonetheless. Shane?
Yes, it has fallen to this.
See, I wrote that one down and didn't include it.
So good. And he grabs... That's when he grabs his magnifying glass to be able to read.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Al's suffering a lot of indignities in these two episodes. That being the least of them. Brian, you want to knock one out?
When they find out about the commissioners, and Johnny Burns just wants, not Johnny, Dan. Dan just wants to kill him. And he says, "Saves time, just travel to one destination, murder the three of them, see how they like being commissioner after they're dead."
That's so good.
Still a little bloodthirsty after even EB told him not to be bloodthirsty in the season finale last season. Speaking of Saul, when William and Martha are, or when everyone is in the hardware store while he's being operated on, and Alma comes in and William and Martha are there, and she says, "How are you, Mr. Star?" And he replies back, "Hi, as shit." huge twice. Making a very awkward scene that much more awkward.
I feel like that's probably something Kissel said in Vegas.
Oh, no, I don't know. I keep control of my business in Vegas. How dare you, sir? How dare you insinuate otherwise?
All right, another one from Al, of course. You would not want to be staring like that at me.
The man is good with the threat.
I'll piggyback off of Kissel's scene and Charlie Utter at the end when it's super awkward. Talks about how we lose more letters than we deliver.
I had that one as well. It's so good. Charlie.
I didn't write down all of Jane's story about the Finnish guy, but that might have... in two very funny episodes, that was the funniest part, easily.
See, I thought her yelling is sometimes just incoherent, but when she's making fun of Al, it's like kind of funny in the teenager sort of way.
Yeah.
Like when she finds out, I got one when she finds out that he's taken forever and she says, ain't it always a trial picking out the gown best conceals you pissed yourself.
Yeah, it's so good. Like, I was laughing out loud to that last night.
The story about the Finnish guy is funny enough. The way it lands, just to utter silence and awkwardness, is as good, if not better. Shane, you got another one?
With you in her ear and other fucking points of entry, I'm all Al today.
Al's on a roll. Another Saul for me. Trixie comes in ranting and raving. And he just raises his arm and says, the old faculties.
Yeah, that's another good one. I didn't write that down. I should have.
So just good. File it away for future use. Yes. In regular conversation.
Yeah, I am. That's going to enter my lexicon.
How about Al does an impersonation of EB, and it might as well be us doing an impersonation of EB. He says, here's your hardware. And let me start that again. Here's your hardware, and he looks a cunt anyway. What? Hold on. I'm struggling with this one.
Can I tag
in? Yeah, you do it, because it took me a while to even type it out.
Here's your hardware, and as he looks a cunt anyway, Al would like you to have this rose.
Now I get to do it. I'm doing it too.
Yeah. Okay.
Here's your hardware, and he looks like a cunt anyway. I would like you to have this rose.
The prop of the whiskey bottle is key to that.
I think it's Adams. It's Adams on the side trying not to.
He's struggling. Like the actor is struggling.
Yes, I've made a note of that.
Titus Welliver. Titus Welliver.
He's fantastic, and he just can't even hold it off. I think there's a reason they filmed it with Al looking away, because there's no way he has great face doing that.
I would imagine that was not the first take.
No.
Speaking of EB, while he's stalking around the Chez Ami trying to find out what's going on, Maddie asks who this weirdo is trying to peep into their whorehouse.
Yes.
And Joey's replies with, pay him no heed, that's the mayor.
Of course, another one of my favorites from the entire season, from the entire series is welcome to fucking Deadwood. Can be combative.
That can be combative is the rare improvised line in Deadwood. It might be the only improvised line in Deadwood.
I didn't know that.
Al just put the tag on the end. Or not Al, Ian McShane just put the tag on the end. And it fit.
It's amazing.
They left it in.
I've got EB that just... The fact that he used the word rut in this is what I was looking for. He's talking about Bullock. He says, he's come back to my hotel. And Al says, Bullock, EB says, upstairs to the widow. I can't say if they're in rut. I didn't linger for the song of the bedstead.
And after each of those sentences, he's pausing, waiting for everyone to like, oh shit, EB, tell me more about that. And no one takes him up on it. He's so pathetic. He's the slimiest asshole that ever lived. No one cares. Everybody knows. Shut the fuck up already, EB.
Right. I was watching it and attempting to do this fantasy baseball draft, and I heard the word rut, and I had to stop and go back and play it a few times. It was so wonderful.
I'm out.
Oh, well. I got one. I got some more. Al with wave a penny under the Jew's nose. Come on, Al.
If there's life in him yet, it's we'll perk right up.
Is that racist? I mean, come on.
Sure.
Grow up.
Yeah, Al. What's the name of the second bartender? The bar that
Johnny?
The bar we don't go to very often.
Harry Manning.
Harry Manning. I don't know who he's talking to. He's talking to Al about his busted ribs. That's right.
Oh, and Tom Nuttall is here.
Tom Nuttall. Okay, there we go. He's talking to Al about his fight injury and his ribs. And he says, I always believed of his sufferings on the cross, his busted ribs would have hurt him the worst. Talking about Jesus, of course. And you're just...
That's a well-composed line.
It is.
You literally say Jesus.
You just assume.
Yeah, there's a lot of assumed... I mean, like the greatest story ever told. But still a lot of assumed language in there.
But, I mean, having attended a number of church services with much too vivid descriptions of this, the ribs do not show up in any of those church services.
No, it's blood-curdling shrieks on an Easter Sunday with a lot of kids in the congregation. I know exactly what you're talking about. Delightful.
I'll use my last one to close when you're done, Shane.
All right, Charlie Utter. Be wrong then, lay there. Unless he's Mexican.
breaking up Bullock's heartfelt pouring out. This is more casual racism.
Shane, do you just
appropriate racism?
Do you just catch all the non-politically correct ones and just have
apparently,
all of those?
Apparently. Okay. I got a soft spot for that, yeah. And my final one, wish her aim was as good with her thumb.
Frontier medicine. Not great.
The last one I've got is something that you just won't hear anymore after Al has his prostitute playing around. He says, he just looks at her and says, close the ass flap.
Completely exhausted. Dead to the world. Close the ass flap.
That line you may never hear in anything ever. So that's a good one.
Deadwood keeping the legacy of pajamas you can shit in alive and well.
Do you have a pair yet?
I do not, no. The time for those may have passed. Although it being keeping with my phone.
Maybe for the mediocrities, you could. We could all get them.
Yeah, we get some monogram ass flap pajamas.
Could you type that into Google and tell us?
Yeah, we've got like 6 months of preparation. We can get this done, no problem. That'll bring us to Cruel Masquerade. This week we're going to be doing the scene where Cy meets Maddie. And is quite unhappy about it. In this rendition, Shane will be playing Cy, Brian will be playing Maddie, and I'll be playing Joni. And Shane will be starting us off whenever he is ready.
Sorry, I'm trying to find a spot here. There he is. Better let me hold Maddie's chair, Joni. I need to make a fucking impression, my lady.
My lord.
Lack of notice is my only regret.
That's my fault for giving Joni none.
Were you hedging your bets, Maddie?
Feared losing my nerve all the way to camp.
Then wondered how that coach brought you to Gettysburg, huh? Gettysburg. Fucking battle carnage.
Yes, I wondered.
What?
Wondered.
You secured that building, honey. When?
November.
Got the building in November. I guess you'll be operating out of. And I thought that the trick would have been behind it, but Jomie's fuck money's been going for Jules. How long have you had that understanding, honey?
Since I was 14.
I've been giving Jules her fuck money since she was 14 years of age. And not once did I come out ahead.
Anyways,
since November, look to me, the project lay fallow, but I guess I was just germinating.
Shall we talk in private, Cy?
Would that be rude?
Not at all.
I mean, an 18-year relationship between me and Joni, just one moment alone?
Of course not.
Suck some pricks if you like. Keep whatever they give you as my way of saying welcome.
Any blind ones out there?
Maddie's a classy bitch. That was me saying that, not Joni. All right, another successful episode of the Mediocre Movie Cast getting wrapped up. Well done, guys. We did it.
We did it. We had a dream and we did it.
Check us out on mediocremovie.club, where this week we're discussing Don Hertzfeld's sci-fi short, World of Tomorrow. Yeah. Maybe watch it. It's a quick 16 minutes, but there's a whole lot of discussing to do there. A lot going on in that 16 minutes. Side pieces, we've got a recently posted review of the movie Carol. We've got a recently posted review of Captain America Civil War. And Game of Thrones podcast, of course, sweeping the country with our hot, hot takes. And follow us on Twitter at Mediocre Movie Cult.
I love that every time. That's a highlight of every podcast.
Yeah. And review us on iTunes. We'd appreciate the 5-star reviews. I'm not going to judge you if you give a 4- or 3-star review, but lower than that, I can't think of any good reason why you would do that. That would just be rude. Thanks for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
It's been a pleasure.
Night all. All right.
Hey, Shane, did you get my note about Cy's speaking pattern?